If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Ah yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus Brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit Trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The Vikings famously raided Britain and Ireland, but they also turned their attentions to Francia and Europe's western seaboard. For today's podcast, our content director, David Musgrove, spoke to Dr. Christian Kooymans to find out more about the interactions between the Vikings and the Franks.
Dr. Christian Kooymans is a research fellow at the University of Liverpool, an expert in the Viking period and author of Monarchs and Hydrarchs, the conceptual development of Viking activity across the Frankish realm, circa 750 to 940. That book was published in hardback a while ago and is out in paperback on 30th September 2021. It's available for pre-order now. So when we think of Viking activity, our thoughts often tend to think about what happened around the coast of Britain and Ireland, particularly for those listeners to this podcast who are based in the UK, I'm sure. Now, recent work has directed attention to Viking movements into Eastern Europe and Russia, and we've talked about that on the podcast too. But what about France and what was then the Frankish realm? That's what we're going to talk about today. So Chris, welcome. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Good. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first question is: we've got this entity called Francia, which is the sort of the main focus of our attention today. What and where was Francia, and when did it exist?
So, Francia was a political territory that covered most of Western continental Europe during the early Viking Age. This was a geographically massive region. So this stretched all the way from Brittany in the west to the Balkans in the east, from the Pyrenees and Italy in the south, to Saxony in the north. So it's an area that would, you know, easily accommodate both Britain and Ireland several times over. Now, Francia is of course named for the Franks, who as a people originally lived in areas around the Rhineland and the Low Countries. But over the course of several centuries, managed to sort of greatly expand their influence and their territories. And by the mid-8th century, this growing kingdom was under the control of a dynasty known as the Carolingians. So the first member of this family to assume the Frankish kingship formally was called Pippin. His nickname was the Short. And he was the father of someone people might be more familiar with, a man called Charles, who would become known as Charles the Great or Charlemagne. And he ruled as king from about the year 768 and was eventually even crowned emperor in 800. So Charlemagne is often considered to be the most successful of the Carolingian rulers. He stimulated, you know, literacy and learning. He brought in economic reform, but he also managed to expand his territories even further, launching these large-scale military campaigns into Lombardy, into Bavaria, into the Slavic territories, as well as Saxony, which would bring the Frankish realm at very close quarters with Scandinavia.
And just thinking about that, so the Viking homelands, Scandinavia, Denmark, Sweden, Norway. So was the Frankish realm actually abutting the sort of the Viking realms at any point?
Charlemagne had led a number of campaigns into Saxony, and Saxony was very much abutting what we now consider Denmark, and that particular region was made subservient to the Frankish realm, was made a subservient area. So in a matter of speaking, yes, the Frankish realm and Denmark were essentially, you know, neighbors by the turn of the century, so by the beginning of the ninth century.
And so with that, what is the earliest evidence we have for interaction, violent or otherwise, between Francia and the peoples from what we would now term Scandinavia?
So we know that links between Francia and Scandinavia were already established sort of long before we see any type of Viking activity taking place. Trade, especially, would have been a key factor in establishing and upholding these sort of long-range connections. And we mostly see this in the archaeological record. We can see that, you know, various types of Frankish ceramics and metalware and glassware and armaments, jewelry, this was already being imported into Scandinavia for many, many years. And that type of trade would have grown significantly by the time we reach the 8th century, with Scandinavia clearly having become part of this, you know, much larger North Sea trade network, which, you know, facilitated all sorts of goods being brought in from not just from Francia, but also from Britain and from, you know, many regions beyond. And it's with these kinds of goods, of course, that Scandinavians became aware of news, of rumors, of ideas all coming in from Francia. And this this is why we assume that Scandinavians would have already been very much attuned to what was happening overseas in the run-up to the Viking Age. Of course, there's more formal lines of communication that were being set up around this time. We see political envoys, for example, being sent between the Carolingians and several Danish kings from the late 8th century onwards. So Viking activity should really be placed within the context of all these sort of earlier interactions. Franks and Scandinavians very much knew about each other, and they interacted on a very regular basis.
So in terms of historiography and our nomenclature and how we devise stuff, when does the Viking Age start then, when we're talking about Francia?
This is a very good question, also a very tricky question. When we're talking about the earliest sort of Viking aggression towards Francia, we usually run into a sort of similar situation to the one that we find in Britain. In Britain, of course, the traditional narrative is that, you know, Lindisfarne off the coast of Northumbria is attacked in 793. And this is, you know, often presented as this watershed event that, you know, changed everything. The Viking Age had now started in Britain. But we know now that was not the case. We have evidence for earlier Viking activity. And it's generally thought that the Viking, you know, phenomenon, if you will, would have emerged much more gradually, not just through, you know, any sort of single event that opened the floodgates. So in Francia, what's traditionally considered to be the first Viking attack took place in 799. when the island of Noirmoutier was allegedly targeted. So this is off the west coast of France, just where the River Loire empties into the Atlantic Ocean. Alcuin of York actually very briefly talks about this in his correspondence. But he mentions pagans attacking multiple islands off the coast of what was then called Aquitaine. So he doesn't specify who they were. He just mentions pagans and pirates, and he doesn't say, you know, which islands in particular. So there is some ambiguity there. But again, this attack has often been held up as this sort of groundbreaking event, which set the Viking Age in Francia in motion. But I think that here, just like for Britain, it's much more nuanced than that. There are some indications that small-scale Viking activity was already much more common along the Frankish coasts during these early decades. And it may simply be the case that, you know, not all of these events were being recorded, either because, you know, the news didn't reach the analysts, or it wasn't considered important enough, or if there was a record, it could have simply been lost over time, which, you know, happened a lot. So I'm a bit skeptical about, you know, putting an actual specific date on the start of the Viking Age in Francia, but I would lean towards it sort of developing gradually from the mid 8th century and shortly thereafter, because then all the sort of different pieces are moving into place, both in Francia and in Scandinavia.
And you mentioned earlier that Francia would have effectively abutted Denmark or the Danish areas. Are we able to say that these early Viking aggressors, the people who were moving in at this early stage, were from what is now Denmark, or could they have been coming from elsewhere in the Viking lands?
It's actually quite tricky to say where a lot of these early Viking attacks were originating. We do have a lot of mentions of Danes and Northmen and pagans and heathens, but these terms are used quite interchangeably in these early annals. We do have a mention of Vestfolders, who would have come from Norway. So that's sort of one of these sort of small, more specific references to the origin of some of these Vikings. But that's only one reference, and we really can't say whether or not any of the others would have come from there. Generally speaking, it's thought that a lot of the people coming in to join these early attacks would have come in from southern Scandinavia. So, you know, Denmark, maybe the southern coasts of Norway, and maybe even some from Sweden. But again, we can't really tell with any degree of certainty.
So it's a complicated picture, but how far are we able to sort of track what's happening in Scandinavia through the 8th and 9th centuries and what's happening in Francia? What are our sources? How can we understand it?
A lot of the evidence that we have for the sort of political situation in Denmark during this time actually comes to us from the Frankish sources, most prominently from the annals that were written by contemporary authors. So we're often looking at all of this through a Frankish lens to begin with. But in these sources, we do get a sense of a much more sort of unified Danish kingship emerging by the later 8th and the early 9th century. We can see various Danish rulers and contenders and political factions appear, some of which were actively supported and sponsored by the Carolingians, and because the Carolingians were hoping to increase their own influence in the region, just like they had done in neighboring Saxony. But in Francia itself, we have, for what's happening in Francia itself, we have a much more sort of distinct picture there. There's a lot of sources. Sources are much more detailed, and we sometimes have multiple perspectives on these events. So we can reconstruct the situation more clearly. So when we're talking about Charlemagne, he died in 814, and his son Louis the Pious then sort of took on the imperial title. And even though Louis' rulership started off relatively stable, it's the 820s and the 830s that are decades that are very much sort of troubled by this political infighting, ongoing infighting between him and his own sons over their royal inheritance. And that eventually, in 840, when he dies, culminated in this all-out civil war across the Frankish realm, which eventually led to the realm being split up into three independently governed kingdoms ruled by these, you know, three surviving heirs of Louis. But even that kind of division wouldn't settle the matter. It would only be an initial step in what was, you know, an ongoing series of political disagreements and succession disputes and rebellions and various other conflicts within Francia throughout the 9th and the 10th century, which, you know, caused political power to become increasingly like decentralized and partitioned. So the glory days of Charlemagne were very much over by the time you're moving into the later 9th century.
So nipping back quickly into the late 8th century, so you mentioned Lindisfarne, 793, and the British perspective. And one of our regular podcast listeners flagged up to me that whenever we do a Viking podcast, I always say Lindisfarne, 793. So I've done it now, but thankfully you said it earlier as well. But I just wanted to say that because we've talked on this podcast before, there's been a bunch of theories and ideas about what initiated the Viking raids into Britain and Ireland. Is there a similar bunch of theories and ideas about what initiates the Viking raids into Francia, and what's your view on what kicks things off?
Yes, there are several theories here. They are also very much tied up. So there's no one sort of single spark or event that caused the Vikings to suddenly make their way into Francia. And I think, you know, these kinds of reasons are very complicated and very much debated. Various different factors would have converged for these groups of people to make their way south. But I think two of them in particular are important when we're looking at Francia. We have this sort of ongoing political consolidation in southern Scandinavia. Regional elites and rulers and sort of, you know, people in power were amassing increasingly large amounts of lands and resources, which caused a lot of their competitors to lose out on those opportunities. And it's those people that may have instead tried to, you know, make their wealth, to try their luck overseas. And combine this then with the growing awareness of the wealth that was available in Francia and the attraction that wealth would have. And you have very distinct sort of push and pull factors, which would have had a strong influence on the start of Viking activity in Francia. Now, of course, there's also the fact that, you know, the Frankish-controlled territories were very close to Denmark, so right next door, as we've discussed. So it would have been very easy to approach the region by just, you know, following the coastline. And accordingly, we do see a lot of early attacks taking place on the areas of Frisia, for example, which correspond to the coastal region of the Netherlands and northwestern Germany, so very close to Scandinavia itself.
And Frisia would have been part of the Frankish.
Yes. Yep. It would have been a sort of subservient region, just like Saxony was.
So you mentioned the wealth of Francia just then. How rich was Francia? How can we assess that? How does it compare, for instance, to Anglo-Saxon England? And how well defended was it?
Generally speaking, the Frankish realm was very sort of affluent. There was lots of landed wealth. There was lots of agriculture, surplus production, lots of trade and artisanship. A lot of this wealth was concentrated as well, particularly in sort of secular elite circles and in the church, in a similar situation that you would see in England at the time. So this would have been very tempting to Vikings, who were very much aware of where a lot of these sort of riches could be found, and you know, just like in Britain, we see wealthy, isolated monastic communities that are situated along the coastlines and the lower river valleys. We also have these large trade centers, such as Dorestad, which is on the Rhine, and Kantovik, which is on the English Channel, and these are sizable commercial hubs and harbors through which a lot of, you know, luxury goods and other portable wealth was making its way in and out of the Frankish realm. But these were all sites that were on the very edges of Frankish influence. So they were remote, they were quite poorly defended, and they were hard to get any sort of, you know, reinforcements to very quickly. And Vikings certainly took advantage of those kinds of weaknesses in particular early on. When it comes to defenses, we do see some defenses being organized early on. Charlemagne made efforts around the turn of the century to build fleets along the English Channel. He set up coast guards along the estuaries of the rivers. But we don't know how successful this would have been. We have one success story, at least, in 820, when coast guards were able to fend off Viking attackers, both in Flanders and along the mouth of the river Seine. And Louis the Pious seems to have continued some of these efforts, but because Francia was gradually descending into this, you know, civil war during the 830s and especially the 840s, military resources became, you know, scarce. They were allocated somewhere else. And these coastal protections would have become much less of a priority. And in turn, that then allowed a lot of these Viking groups to slip, you know, through the cracks, if you will. It's not until later on when we talk about the kingship of Charles the Bald, who was king of Western Francia during the 860s and the 870s, that we see more sort of structural and successful efforts again being made to sort of ward off this incoming Viking aggression.
And talking about Viking aggression, are you able to give us a sense about what an 8th or early 9th century Viking attack might have been like?
Yeah, sure. So the earliest attacks in around Francia wouldn't really have been that different from what you would, you know, experience in Britain or in Ireland. They would have been mostly small scale, sort of smash and grab type affairs, focused on these coastal and these peripheral settlements. If you were a member of, you know, a monastic community, or you were maybe a merchant in one of these places, and you would see, you know, a Viking flotilla approach, even if it was just a very small one, there might be some cause for concern. You could expect to have, you know, a particularly bad day. Vikings, just like in Britain, were after movable wealth, precious metals, silver, gold, but also after food stockpiles, for example, harvests, cattle. And of course, people themselves were also captured, either to be, you know, ransomed at a later time or even to be sold into slavery. And during these attacks, some of the houses and workshops and storage areas could have been burnt or otherwise, you know, destroyed. And because many of these settlements were largely constructed of combustible materials, even an accidental fire could have, you know, spread out of control quite quickly. But from the Frankish sources, we do get a strong impression that this destruction wasn't, you know, generally wholesale or random. Vikings seem to have made sure not to completely, you know, decimate the places they attacked. They would make sure not to take all the wealth, to not capture the, you know, the entire population. And it seems that they did this deliberately to keep those places viable, to allow them to rebuild, to make sure that, you know, communities and wealth and life could return to these places ultimately, so that Vikings themselves could also come back, you know, at a later point in time. There's a prominent example there, the trade center of Dorestad, which was situated along the River Rhine in what's now the central Netherlands. So this was probably the largest and the busiest commercial site in northern Francia during the early 9th century. And Viking groups are seen to have attacked Dorestad four times over the course of four consecutive years during the 830s. And that's all recorded by authors at the time. But the language that they use is generally quite sort of unconditional. They say that, you know, everything got burned down. It was all laid waste. Everything was devastated. But it's very clearly hyperbolic, because what would be the point of returning again and again to a place that was completely demolished? If anything, between the lines, we can see Vikings exercising some sort of, you know, restraint. They were planning ahead. They were keeping part of the wealth and the infrastructure intact to allow these settlements to recover over time.
You've just written a research paper about Dorestad, haven't you?
Yes, I did.
So it's interesting you make that point about the hyperbolic language. Has Dorestad been subject to archaeological excavation? Does that in any way prove or disprove what you just said about the hyperbole in the written sources?
Yes. So Dorestad has been subject to extensive archaeological excavation over the course of several decades, especially during the 20th century. There have been, you know, some limited sort of indications of that there could have been a Scandinavian presence in that trade settlement. But we don't see, you know, the expected burn layers, for example, where you see a lot of sort of evidence of fire, large scale fires that would, you know, that would indicate destruction on a large scale. We don't see that in Dorestad. So again, that points to a lot of this reporting being very sort of exaggerated and hyperbolic. It wasn't probably as bad as all that, is the sense we're getting.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It's not until later decades that we really start to see these enormous sums presented by Frankish rulers to Vikings in order to appease them. Often made up of thousands of pounds in silver and in gold, but sometimes also including things like livestock and flour and wine and cider.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
So you mentioned just now in your previous answer that, that sort of a Viking raid in Francia would probably be quite similar to a Viking raid in England. I wonder, that leads me on to the question about how the story connects across the North Sea, across the English Channel, and how it gels together. I assume that if defences are strengthened and defensive strategy is enhanced in England, then activity then refocuses in Francia and it goes the other way. Is that how it sort of all fits together? Because it's clearly, we can't just talk about Francia and not mention the fact that there were raids going on the other side of the Channel.
Yeah. You know, you're absolutely right there. Viking endeavor in Francia is very much intertwined with what's going on in Britain at the same time. None of this was happening, you know, in a vacuum. Not only do we see the same kind of progression in Viking activity, starting with these, you know, small scale attacks and moving into sizable campaigns as time goes on, but we can even see the same Viking groups being active on both sides of the channel sometimes, and there are, as you say, there are waves of this kind of activity that seem to alternate between the continent and Britain. So during the 860s and the 870s, for example, when the so-called, you know, Great Army was active in England, we see a decline of Viking activity in Francia. And then afterwards, when Vikings were defeated by King Alfred at Edington in 878, we see a renewed wave of Viking aggression in the northern parts of Francia. So these were definitely sort of interrelated waves of activity. And Vikings took advantage of you know, political instability and domestic conflict without feeling constrained to one particular region or another.
And you just mentioned then that there's kind of a progression of Viking activity and the nature of activity as we move through the period. When does Viking activity in Francia change from coastal raiding, the limited coastal raiding that you outlined earlier, to something else, something bigger, different? And why does that happen?
This happens from the 840s onwards specifically. We see Viking activity in Francia becoming a much more sort of commonplace occurrence with more participants and more ships involved. And the targets of these attacks also change. So they're no longer just focused on these peripheral harbors and monasteries. They now also include much larger and wealthier and more politically important population centers, often located far upriver, sometimes hundreds of kilometers. Starting in 841, we have the town of Rouen on the Seine, which is attacked alongside various monasteries. In 843, Nantes on the Loire, quite a sizable town, was attacked, and the bishop would have even been killed during that attack. In 844, we see Toulouse attacked along the river Garonne, which is in the far south of the Frankish realm. And in 845, Vikings were also able to reach Paris for the very first time. So these weren't just, you know, quick hit and run attacks anymore. These were complex strategic campaigns, some of which went right into the heart of the Frankish realm. Now, why that was happening is more difficult to answer. There would have, of course, been competition along, you know, these Viking groups that were active along the coastlines. These fleets were growing, more resources were required. There was a risk of scarcity along the coast. So that may have driven some of these groups further inland. But probably more importantly is that a civil war was raging in Francia at this time, which was very happily taken advantage of by Vikings. Several authors during the period actually blame Frankish rulers for being too focused on their internal affairs, and taking very little sort of notice of this incoming threat, basically sort of opening the gates for Vikings to just come in and make themselves at home. So it's not even just with hindsight that we can, you know, detect these patterns and these developments. People were very much aware of it at the time as well.
So with that civil war that was raging in the Frankish realm, did that hinder the defensive response by the Franks to the Viking attacks? Were they able to mount any sort of coordinated defense, or was that impossible given what was going on?
It was increasingly difficult to mount any sort of effective defense. The three surviving heirs of Louis the Pious were all ruling a separate kingdom at this point. There was no longer a unified Frankish realm, and all these military resources were now used to attack each other and were to quell sort of internal rebellions. There was a lot of sort of there were a lot of political games being played within Francia itself at the time, and that seems to have sort of drained a lot of these resources, a lot of sort of political volatility and military resources just being taken away from the coasts, because, you know, those were needed elsewhere. And the Vikings were very, very quick to sort of pounce on that situation and say, like, okay, we can now, I guess there are no coast guards anymore. We can just move into the Seine. We can just move in, you know, onto the Rhine or onto the Loire, and you know, we have much much more convenient access, much more unopposed to these much larger centers of political you know, importance and movable wealth.
So you've got Frankish sort of weakness and instability, and Viking strength and opportunism, I guess. Maybe now's a good point to just talk about a word you use in your book title, Hydrarx and Hydrarchy, because that sort of talks about how the Vikings organize themselves. What does that word mean? Where does it come from, and why are we talking about it?
Hydrarchy is a system of social organization that considers Viking ships and fleets as these sort of ambulant political spaces in their own right. They were operating sort of outside traditional structures of power. So these were politically and socially very flexible and adaptive groups. They were self-sustaining, self-governing, and they were commanded, of course, by these individual Viking leaders, but presumably by consent of the entire group. So these weren't, you know, absolute rulers. And I often call these hydrarchs. And these Viking groups were very much informed on the social and the political and the economic developments in Francia at the time. And they're seen to adjust their plans accordingly. They were very opportunistic, for sure, but also very rational and calculated in their actions. We can see them joining forces with other Viking groups when they needed to. For example, when there was a large target to assail somewhere up the river. And then after those campaigns, they would split up again just as easily. But also we see that their activities were not just violent. They engaged in trade. They set up very long-lasting encampments sometimes. And they were politically also very active. So the notion of hydrarchy is very far removed from the sort of age-old cliche of the reckless, capricious Viking, you know, who's almost sort of frothing at the mouth, seething with rage. That really doesn't seem to correspond to the reality of Viking activity. And we see that as time went on, these groups, these Viking groups, often did not return to Scandinavia. Certainly not, you know, on an annual basis, but maybe not even at all anymore. They were in it for the long haul. This was a very prolonged, sort of sustained Viking life for many. And we see these Viking groups described as traveling with entire family units. We have, the presence of women and children noted by analysts at the time. And these groups may have also formed their own identities with their own distinct characteristics, like their own, you know, iconography, their own flags, their own sort of outward appearance, their style of dress, even the way they spoke, the language that they used. And we even know about a number of instances in which people from Francia, several monks and a former ruler, in fact, actively joined up with the Vikings. And seem to have traveled and lived with them. So hydrarchy may have offered opportunities, not just for people from Scandinavia, but also offered these opportunities and social mobility to people in Francia in a way that just wasn't otherwise available in Frankish society.
That's a really interesting take on the nature of these Viking groups. That's fascinating. Thanks for that. But I'm just wondering. So, I mean, the Franks themselves, just going back to their response, they weren't completely defensive. They did come up with some ideas. And one of the things in your book that I was interested in was kind of the idea of export bans, kind of stopping sales of weapons and horses. Is that right? Did I read that right?
Yeah. You did read that right. To sort of oppose this ongoing and unchecked Viking activity in the Frankish realm, in the Western Frankish kingdom especially, a major piece of legislation was promulgated by King Charles the Bald, who was the king of Western Francia during this period. And this piece of legislation is called the Edict of Pitre, and this was this is from the year 864. And this document not only addressed, you know, the organization of his armies and the building of fortifications, but also specifically talks about trade between Vikings and domestic merchants. So what it says is that, and I'm paraphrasing here, whoever provides the Northmen with any weapons or armor or horses will be considered a traitor to the realm and to Christianity and be put to death. So that's a very, very strongly worded clause. But the fact that this is explicitly mentioned in that edict suggests that these transactions were still very commonplace. People were still trading with the Vikings. And it wasn't just Vikings trading with other Vikings. It was clearly domestic merchants doing it. The fact that it's mentioned sort of confirms that. Otherwise, there would have been no need to mention that at all. And I think it provides a very valuable insight into how Vikings obtained their necessities when they were on the move. They didn't just, you know, steal things or you know, produce things themselves. They actively purchased their goods. They participated in the regional economy, if you will. And I think this sort of, you know, underlines that their actions would not have been exclusively violent.
That is a bit of a head scratch, isn't it? Because you kind of expect, you think, oh, here come the Vikings, sail up the river, kill the monks, steal all the stuff and go away again. But you're describing a situation where they're coming along, they're up the river and they're trading, which is a very different spin on things.
Yeah. And in some cases, there might even have been, you know, scenarios where Vikings may have attacked a specific settlement or a town or a monastery and then use the spoils of those attacks to trade with, you know, at another point further down the river or somewhere else in the region. So there's a very sort of dynamic aspect to Viking activity overall there.
And just thinking about the Viking involvement and interaction with the regional economy, that brings us on to the idea of people paying them to stop activity or to go somewhere else or to fight someone else, to be mercenaries on someone else's part. When did that idea of paying off Vikings start to come into play?
The payment of tributes seems to have started very early on. So some of the earliest Viking campaigns in Francia, so right at the beginning of the 9th century, already seem to have involved these kinds of payoffs, mostly on a local scale at that point. It's not until later decades that we really start to see these enormous sums presented by Frankish rulers to Vikings in order to appease them, often made up of thousands of pounds in silver and in gold, but sometimes also including things like livestock and flour and wine and cider. And it's the size, the scale of these tributes that provides a sense of how massive and imposing these Viking forces would have become at this point, just to be able to demand and receive those kinds of sums. And I think that demanding tributes may have even been a preferred strategy for Vikings to obtain that kind of wealth at that point, because it would have involved, you know, no violence. It would have involved relatively little risk to them. It would have been the threat of violence more than the actual violence at that point. But it seems that these kinds of payments, when they were this big, were not, you know, directly derived from the royal coffers, if you will. They would come from taxes and from the treasuries of churches, which you can imagine made them very, very unpopular overall. And their effectiveness, of course, is also, you know, questionable, just like they may have been in England. Because if you pay off one Viking group, you may have bought yourself some time, but by doing so, you could have inspired another group to just, you know, come up and demand the same thing. So it was a deeply sort of precarious strategy for rulers to pursue.
Yeah, and people in England found the same consequences, didn't they? You've outlined sort of defensive measures there. What I often wonder with these stories is the more offensive side of things. Did anyone in Francia ever suggest taking the fight to the Vikings on their home ground? Was that ever like a feasible proposition for anybody to do?
that's a great question. The answer, the simple answer is not really. Charlemagne is seen to have made some preparations and efforts that might suggest that he was planning to invade Denmark, but following his death, Frankish rulers and resources were not generally organized and unified enough to be able to launch any sort of, you know, large scale assault into Scandinavia. We mostly see diplomatic efforts continue throughout over the course of the 9th century. Also, when we look at this through the lens of hierarchy, there may not even be such a thing as, you know, a home ground in this situation. There is no, you know, the Viking homelands. Many Viking groups would not have been that strongly tied to Scandinavia anymore, and they certainly weren't, you know, controlled by any single political force there. So even if you were to have some sort of, you know, military action taken against Scandinavia, it certainly wouldn't have done all that much to stop Viking activity in Francia, I think.
Loads of really interesting questions there about identity, about how people consider themselves. And that leads into one of my sort of closing questions, actually. Is anyone who knows anything about the history of Normandy would know that Normandy was essentially settled by people from the north, and there was a deal in the start of the 10th century for that to happen. And at what point did the Viking raiders become more settled in Francia? How and why did that happen? And I guess also, what does that mean for identity? When did Vikings start to think of themselves as not Vikings, if they even, I mean, that's a stupid question. Have a go at that. I'm rambling wildly.
So in Francia, we don't really see the same kind of transition between Viking attacks and Viking settlement in the way we might see it happening, in the Danelaw in England, for example, or even in the Scandinavian settlements in Ireland. On the continents, these Vikings seem to have had a much sort of tougher time elbowing their way into these political systems. Viking groups attacked the region. They built, encampments. They were active over the course of years and decades. But throughout the 9th century, we don't really get a sense that Vikings were settling down across Francia in any sort of especially large numbers. Now, by the 10th century, we do see some Scandinavian settlement taking place. And that's, of course, as you mentioned, in Normandy. There we have, a Viking called Rollo who received that territory in benefice during the early 10th century. And that went hand in hand with a much more sort of durable and successful Scandinavian settlement. But the rise of Normandy as this Scandinavian controlled political region is a bit of a blind spot, evidence-wise. A lot of the established narrative that we take for granted about Normandy is on quite shaky ground. And much of this is due to just one particular author, a man called Dudot of Saint-Quentin, who wrote a text called the Historia Normannorum, which is the history of the Normans. But that was only composed in the early 11th century. So it's a much sort of later work. And he was commissioned to do so by the Dukes of Normandy at the time. And he wasn't necessarily interested in historical accuracy, and his patrons weren't either. So the goal was to justify, to celebrate, to eulogize, these Norman dukes. So it was effectively a piece of propaganda. And as a result, we really have to take a lot of this sort of account with a pinch of salt, and we can't really say much about, the figure of Rollo and the early rise of Normandy. What we can tell from sources is that we start to see a more systematic Scandinavian settlement around this period when land grants were made to Rollo and his successors, a region which roughly corresponded to the area we now call Normandy. But that settlement isn't that clearly seen in the historical or the archaeological record necessarily. It's something we see most clearly in the local place names, if anything. There are hundreds of Old Norse place names and place name elements that survive in the landscape of Normandy, and they point to an active sort of reorganization of that region, that land under Norman rule. But as that influence expanded, the Scandinavian cultural element, that identity of being Vikings, would have gradually weakened, I think, through assimilation, through intermarriage, through fosterage, through cohabitation. So it's already difficult to say by the later 10th and the 11th century, so just a few generations later, how Scandinavian these rulers and these people still were. But then again, Normandy is probably still remains one of sort of the major legacies of the Viking Age in Francia. It was an incredibly successful venture overall. And it's the descendants of Rollo that would, eventually go on to make their way across the Channel and conquer England.
And some people sometimes say that 1066 Norman Conquest was kind of the last Viking attack. Do you buy into that sort of language? Is that a silly way of thinking about things?
It's the same as with the 793 attack on Lindisfarne. Really, it's just a way of sort of bookending this particular period. But again, it would have been a gradual sort of a gradual process of change. It would have been in Scandinavia, society had radically changed at this point. In Francia, conditions were different. In England, conditions were different. So I don't necessarily buy into 1066. It's a nice sort of event that you can stick on the end of it. But it would have been more a more gradual sort of slow process, and a lot of it, you know, would not have been, you know, as you know, strongly recorded. It was all happening in the background, a very sort of, you know, a nexus of different sort of economic, social, political factors all coming together.
So if we can't sort of identify a really good end point to the story, Chris, what's the legacy of the Viking Age? You think how do we understand this now in Francia?
The legacy of the Viking Age in Francia, that story seems to draw to a close by the late 10th and probably maybe early 11th century. And that's mostly because Viking activity is no longer really as much of an issue around the Frankish realm anymore. A lot of this activity starts to become more focused on England and Ireland during this period. And we only see sporadic attacks at this time. And most of the action is now really focused on Normandy. You know, Normandy itself, as I mentioned, being, you know, probably the most notable legacy of the Viking Age in Francia, a successful sort of Scandinavian settlement in the Frankish realm. Even the name itself, you know, refers to the Northmen. But again, the specifics of the rise of Normandy are very much sort of debated, and there's a lot of work still to be done there.
Well, thank you, Chris. That's been a really interesting tour of Viking Francia, and your book gives a lot more detail about it. And one of the really interesting things, and I was reading a review about it, which was very, very positive about the book. And one of the things it said was that you detail so much material about the Viking raids that happened in Francia, which is previously not really been available to in English scholarship, and there are some amazing lists that you've got together of the lists of Viking raids that go through the century. So it's well worth a look. I mean, there was one that I was fascinated by, a Viking raid down on the Dordogne at one point, which seems you know, we go on holidays to the Dordogne, don't we? But so to see the Vikings going, I mean, that shouldn't surprise us, I guess, given that, you know, what we know about the Vikings going way far into the east and down the rivers into Russia and Eastern Europe and Asia potentially. So it shouldn't really be a surprise that they were heading that far into what's now southwest France, is it?
Yeah, no, it's in the overarching histories of the Viking Age that, you know, especially sort of the English language histories, that the Viking presence in Francia is usually only very briefly sort of touched upon, if at all. It receives very limited coverage to the point where people are sometimes surprised to hear that, you know, Vikings even went to the European mainland at all, you know, never mind the scale and the scope of that activity. And it's certainly not because, you know, there's less material to work with. Not at all. I mean, Viking activity was just as commonplace and dynamic as it would have been in Britain or Ireland, for example. There's tons of evidence that we have. It's just that, you know, a lot of the source material is very difficult to come by, either because, you know, a lot of it hasn't been translated from their Latin originals, or simply because, you know, research about Vikings in Francia appears in French, in German, in Dutch, and that might raise the threshold for some readers to find out about this kind of regional activity.
That was Christian Kooymans. If you're interested to find out more about this period, then we've selected 9 more Viking podcasts that you might be interested in listening to. You can find that list on our website at historyextra.com/Viking-pods. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on the future of period drama.